Members, I have the following apologies. Apology from Ms. Advocate Glenys Breytenbach, Mr. Werner Horn, Mr. The other member of the DA. They will not be available this week. Honorable Breytenbach is undergoing surgery. Honorable Stealth and Honorable Werner Horn also have tendered their apologies for the whole of this week. Any other apologies?
No, Chairperson, we didn't see something.
Okay. Honorable members, Mr. Dupuis did apologize for sending the document late. He had a very short time between the time we dealt with the bill and today to do research and ensure that we have a working draft. But he has been in communication with us that he would not be in a position to send the document yesterday. They were still working on the document, and bearing in mind the amount of work that they are doing within such a short space of time, we said we will apologize on his behalf to the committee. Mr. Dupuis, can you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Chair. Mr. Chair, before I start, Christina Buerta is here with me in my office. So she's also attending the meeting, and if there are any questions that the committee would like to raise with her, she is available. Mr. Chair, we have marked this document, working document number 3, only merely for our working, for our record purposes. But the document is actually still, in essence, working document number 2 with additional information in it, Mr. Chair. And what I would like to indicate at this stage, with regard to the first set of amendments which deal with the substantive offences in the Act, if I recall correctly, Mr. Chair, the committee at its Friday's discussion, I got the impression that the committee might be in a position to choose one of the 3 options under the incest provision, and then also the to choose between the 2 options between the sexual intimidation provision. Now, Mr. Chair, if I can take you to the incest provision.
Mr. Dupuis?
Yes, sir.
Can you deal with your mic? We can't hear you properly.
Sorry, Chair, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Right, Mr. Chair, maybe to start all over again, the Section 12 dealing with incest, we prepared 3 options for the committee, and from Friday's discussions, we got the impression that the committee is in a position to choose between those 3 options, and it would appear from the discussions that option 3 is preferred. Now, what we would like to do as early as possible with the view to preparing the amendments for the committee is to start cleaning up this document of ours, Mr. Chair. So, with your permission, we would like to then omit option 1 and option 2 from the document, so that under section 12, we only reflect the option 3, which was the preferred option in the committee on Friday, and then the same with the sexual intimidation provision. We also got a clear indication from the committee that the committee prefers the second option. So once again, we would like to start cleaning up the document and getting rid of all our strike throughs, etc., so that we have a clear indication of how the provision would look like. I don't know whether you would like to respond to that request at this stage, Mr. Chair.
Let me see if other members are with you. Members, there is the proposal from Mr. Dupuis. What is your view? Members, yes, you can just speak because I'm not able to see hands. Honorable Mfukeng.
I'm saying that the chair is in order.
It's in order.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mfukeng. Other members?
Yes, Chair, Swatia, I'm in agreement with Honorable Mfukeng. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. So you can, any person who disagrees? None. You can proceed, Mr. Dupuis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. Then, with regard to the second portion of the amendments contained in the bill as introduced, they deal with Chapter 6 of the Act. Now, allow me, Mr. Chair, maybe just to make a few introductory remarks with regard to Chapter 6 itself. The definitions in Section 40 are very important for purposes of interpreting Chapter 6. But Chapter 6 relates to the employment relationship between an employer and an employee. And currently, as Chapter 6 stands at the moment, an employee or a potential employee will be prohibited from working in an environment where they work with or have access to children or persons who are mentally disabled. Now, that is the restricted ambit of Chapter 6, restricted to children. The prohibition is restricted to children and persons who are mentally disabled. But if we start looking at the definition of vulnerable person, then we will see that the ambit will be extended to include those individuals referred to in the definition of vulnerable persons. And that has a certain impact on the ambit of Chapter 6. However, to start from the beginning again, under Clause 5, we have the proposed amendments to employer, where reference to a child or a person who is mentally disabled will be, or it is proposed to be replaced with a person who is vulnerable. But then you will recall, Mr. Chair, that the committee received comments which indicated that the access to or congregate, where those persons congregate, requirements might become onerous and might also throw the net too wide. And the department indicated to the committee that there's one of two options, either access to or the term congregate could be restricted to children and certain persons with disabilities, or then the second option is to remove the access to or congregate requirement, which it would appear to the department might be the better approach at this stage. So just to explain to the committee what they are seeing now is that is option one, and we give an indication how the proposed amendments should look like if we restrict the access to requirements to children and persons with certain persons with disabilities. And then the second and possibly preferred option at this stage would then be to indicate to the committee how the provision will look like if those requirements are then omitted from the definition of employer. If there aren't any questions in this regard, Mr. Chair, I will proceed to the next definition.
Members, if you have any questions or any comments, just shout. I'm not able to see you. None, which means you can proceed, Mr. Dupris. You can proceed, Mr. Dupris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When it comes to the definition of person who is vulnerable, Mr. Chair, the option one that was presented or that is presented to the committee is the version of the definition as it was contained in the introduced version of the bill, and we indicated to the committee that we had to effect a technical correction to that definition. The committee then requested us to prepare two additional options. The one option or option two here is then the option that is the wide option, including many different categories of persons.
Yes, we are moving too fast, bearing in mind that we did not have an overnight time to look at the document. You're moving too fast.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. The second option then is the wide option, and the definition of person who is vulnerable will or could then read in paragraph A, a child or a person who is mentally disabled. Both those terms are already defined in section 1 of the Act. Then a female under the age of 25 years, which would include all females, a person who is being cared for or sheltered in a facility that provides services to victims of crime. Under paragraph B, a person with a physical, intellectual, or sensory disability and who receives community-based care and support services. And then Roman 2 and Roman 3 is then also self-explanatory. In paragraph E, we have persons who are 60 years of age or older and who receive similar care in certain facilities. Then under paragraph A, we were requested to include members from the LGBTIQ plus community. And here, I would like to pause for a moment because I need to report back to the committee on a request that we have received on Friday. But the proposal that was considered on Friday by the committee is a person who is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, asexual, or queer. But the department also proposed or placed before the committee two options for consideration. The one is a person with a characteristic that identifies that person as a member of a group that recognizes itself as transgender, intersex, or according to its sexual orientation. And the second option was a person who is transgender, intersex, or a person who is a result of his or her sexual orientation could be identified as a member of a group that is generally recognized as such. The committee requested the department on Friday to consult further on this, and we were able to receive an input from an organization called Access 2, and the lady who assisted me clearly is very knowledgeable, and she really assisted me very quickly, and she came back with a quick response, and I was very appreciative of that. So what we did, Mr. Chair, we included for you an option three and an option four. Now, the proposal from that organization is one of two. The first one, option three, they propose a person who is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, or queer. The only concern that I have with regard to that option three is that we don't see reference to asexuality. Be that as it may, Mr. Chair, option four is a very good proposal to our minds. They propose that the alternative could be that it's a person who is a member of a social group consisting of individuals who are transgender, intersex, or whose sexual orientation is gay, lesbian, bisexual, or who falls under any other category that deems them a gender or sexual orientation minority. And if you refer to the sexual orientation minority, that would in all likelihood then include a reference to asexuality. So at this stage, and as I said, Mr. Chair, we received this proposal late yesterday afternoon. So one would like to have a better look at it, but it would appear that this is a solid proposal. I'm going to pause here, Mr. Chair, because I think there might be a response from your committee members in this regard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree. Any comments from members?
Chairperson?
Ms. Mufuke?
Thank you very much, Mr. Dupree. I think we really appreciate the consultation, and I can say that option four is the one that comes out very clear. It doesn't discriminate against anyone, and therefore I agree with you that you can still go and look at other options, but this is the best ever for on my view. Thank you
very much, Honorable Mafuke. Other members?
Honorable Wilma.
Honorable
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to everyone present. I would take the widest option if possible. I would support the widest option. Thank you, Chair.
The widest option is option, which one is that? Is it option four?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Honorable Newbold Jahans supports Honorable Mpuke.
Chairperson.
Honorable Jela.
Before you move out from that point of agreeing on or supporting Honorable Mofokeng, I just want to make a comment, but I want to thank Mr. Dupree for the good work that they are doing. But I want to find out, because I heard him saying it's only one person who came forth with those proposals or addition. I just want to find out that if it happens that before we close this matter and get out of it, if maybe there is one or two from other organizations who get them, because I'm not sure if maybe what criteria that we have used in inviting these the people to come and comment, because I would think that the person who made this comment is somebody who was listening, who was with us maybe on that day when this matter was raised. I want to find out what if it happens that somebody comes after today with another or addition on the proposal, what is going to happen? Are we going to allow to add and then before we close, or are we just saying no, we are happy with this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before Mr. Dupree's response, this is not a stage for public comments, members. We are at a stage where we are doing clause by clause. This bill was open to members of the public to make comments, which that stage has passed. We are at a different stage now. It was a specific instruction from the committee just to get a better phrasing of the clause that maybe he can generally bounce his views and ideas with people who are involved in that space. The process is entirely now in the hands of the committee. If we are at a stage where we say that we are sure that we agree with clause 4 or option 4, but before we adopt the bill and then we find that there is an earth-shattering definition that if we don't include it, the bill might be defective. There's nothing wrong stopping the committee from accepting that. But this should not be construed as a process of public comment stage. We have passed that stage. Honorable Jele, I'm not sure whether I answer your question.
No, I'm happy, Chair. I'm happy. I wanted to get only clarity on that because as you said, Chair, I wanted to make sure that everybody, we are on the same page. Thank you.
And I think it's an important question, Honorable Jale, because we should continuously keep members of the public and other stakeholders here clarified on the processes we're embarking on. I think it was important that you asked that question. Mr. Dupree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I don't know whether I could be allowed now to clean up this portion of the definition as well. I just want to mention, Mr. Chair, that this option or this portion of the definition of a vulnerable person, it would have the interesting consequence that employers in future and potential employers in future will have to ask persons who apply for employment what their sexual orientation or their gender orientation is, precisely because of the fact that you need to determine whether the person you are going to appoint is a vulnerable person. And if that is the case, then you as an employer will then be aware of the fact that you will have to take the other employees. I'm just mentioning that, Mr. Chair, so that one could expect in future when you apply for a job, you will be asked what your sexual orientation is, or your gender, well, yes, your sexual gender. Just mentioning that, Mr. Chair, by the way.
But will it be mandatory for a person to respond? Because others...
Chair, I doubt it, but...
Okay.
I doubt it, Chair, but then one would start asking the question whether one is not watering down the prohibition of persons who have been convicted of sexual offences to work with vulnerable persons. But I hear the question, Chair, and yes, I suppose it is a response to what was just mentioned to you. Mr. Chair, then Then under paragraph G, remember that this is also the Y option. And we were also in, this is actually a comment that the committee received during the public hearing, is that persons who are cared for or sheltered in places that are created for asylum seekers or refugees should also be included under this wide definition. We have discussed, or the committee discussed this issue at length on Friday, and that was the request by one of your members to see whether it would be possible for Parliament to provide the minister with the power to extend the definition. And if I remember correctly, the conclusion of the discussions was that this paragraph should rather be removed. Then proceeding to option 3, which is aimed at focusing on the most vulnerable of vulnerable persons. Under paragraph A, once again, we've got a child or a person who's mentally disabled. Now, with regard to females under the age of 25 years, the aim here was to restrict females to those who are most vulnerable females. And Roman paragraph 1 formed part of the option that the committee considered on Friday, but then the committee also made comments and referred us to additional categories of persons. And in Roman 2, it is proposed that females who receive vocational training at any training institute other than the institutions referred to in subparagraph 1, which is your higher education institutions mentioned in the Higher Education Act, or those females who receive vocational training as part of their employment. And then a third category is added, or proposed to be added, and those are the females who live in a building or a structure or a facility used primarily as a residence for any of the persons referred to in subparagraphs 1 and 2. So that was an attempt, Mr. Chair, to talk about the university hospitals and residences, etc. There was a question that we should also consider including the unemployed, but that raised a number of questions among the drafters, Mr. Chair, and that is it really possible to identify a person who is unemployed as a person who is vulnerable, because the definition only really becomes relevant when you find yourself in an employment situation. In other words,
apologies, Mr. Chair, and apologies, Mr. Dupriya. Your internet, your audio was breaking up. Would you mind repeating this last section that you're referring to?
Certainly, thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, yes. The attempt is made here to restrict females under the age of 25 years to those who might be identified as the most vulnerable in that age category. And Roman 1 formed part of the option that the committee considered on Friday, but then further discussions took us to the point today where we propose the addition of Roman paragraph 2 and Roman paragraph 3. And in Roman 2 then, we refer to females who receive vocational training at any training institute other than the institutes referred to in Roman 1. And then in number 3, we refer to females under the age of 25 years who live in a building, structure or facility used primarily as a residence for any of the persons referred to in both Romans 1 and 2. Now, you will recall, Mr. Chair, that there was also a request to consider including unemployed females under paragraph B. But when we considered that, a number of questions came up, and that is why we haven't included it yet. And I think the committee might want to debate it further, but if you look at the purpose of the definition of a person who is vulnerable, we must remind ourselves that during the employment situation where employees and employers are involved, so it's difficult to imagine a scenario where an unemployed person could be regarded within the employment sphere as a person who is vulnerable. So the question was raised, is it feasible and does it serve any useful purpose to include persons who are unemployed under paragraph B of this option? I'm going to pause here, Mr. Chair, if there might be any comments in this regard.
Members? Are we helping Honorable Scott?
I appreciate the explanation, and I am in agreement now. I have a better understanding what I would do, and I don't want to take us back, but the rationale for the insertion of Roman 1, 2, and 3, as opposed to the bill introduced, which just covered all females under the age of 25, is, to me, at my reading, it does slightly limit the protection with Roman 1, 2, 3. And just very briefly, why we decided to change it to those Roman 1, 2, 3 when the bill as introduced was all females under the age of 25.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Mr. De Vries.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, it was highlighted at some stage that if you include all females, it would practically entail the whole labor force of South Africa. If I can use an example, if you think on the parliamentary precinct, there are females who are under the age of 25 years, and that would mean that everyone in the parliamentary precinct, including the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, will have to be vetted. And that's only our national legislature. If you think about the provincial legislatures as well, the municipal councils, that's just to give you one slight example of what the impact would be of including 25 years, persons 25 years under the age, unrestricted. Now, that will have a ripple effect on the ability of who eventually must issue the certificates. You can imagine for yourself, just thinking about the parliamentary precinct, how many applications for certificates will be submitted within a very short space of time. And as we explained previously, paragraph B does have a drafting history where we originally looked at aiming to restrict 25 years, the category, to those who are most vulnerable and where one knows that instances of sexual offences do occur. and that is usually the emphasis being placed then on persons who study or receive other forms of training. So in other words, strictly speaking, students where they study and students where they live. May I proceed, Chair?
Chair, sorry.
Other members want to come back, Honourable Sir.
I just don't understand the issue of the vetting, because you're not vetting people who are vulnerable, you're vetting people that will be dealing with people who are vulnerable. Is that my correct understanding?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, entirely correct. But let's just give you a simple example, and please bear with me. Let's say I am an employer who works with children, and I employ 150 persons. Now, currently, under the current system, I have to vet them because they work with children. But strictly speaking, when a person who is 25 years old applies for a job in my organization, the possibility is strong, not always, but the possibility is strong that I will have to vet all the employees again. So there might be situations where employers have vetted their employees, but that it might be required that they should be vetted again. But that's just the concern that one has. Extending the definition of vulnerable persons, of course, then extends the a number of employers who must vet their employees when someone under paragraph B applies for a job, and that will have an increase on the number of applications for certificates. I don't know whether I can take it any further, Chair. I see that you have a question.
Chair, I agree with Honourable Swart that this one it also needs a discussion and we look further. I totally agree with him and I'll tell you why. I don't understand and where does the vetting issue be a problem if somebody is working and if for this government. We are talking about the fourth industrial revolution, and I said even last, that we should never hide behind what will happen with the overload. It should be how are we going to improve our systems to get things going. And I really think that we need to look at this issue very, very seriously, because women generally, it doesn't matter which age, they are whether at home or they are at work, they are vulnerable at all times. And this one still becomes a thorn in my flesh, I must be honest. Maybe we need to relook at this in a serious way. And we need people to really give an input, advice, but I agree with Honorable Swart, I'm really worried about this part.
Other members, thank you, Honorable Mfuken.
Honorable Nibert wants to say something.
Okay. I would ask members just to speak because I can't see them. Honorable Nibert Rachens. Honorable Nibert Rachens.
Chair, let me come in before.
Okay.
I think I agree with my colleagues also, because I think it takes us back to the question that was asked exactly, why 25, why not 35? Though we can't go back to those issues. I think the reasoning was still the same, that they are going to have a lot of work, they can't extend the years and all that because of what is forwarded today. I think I support my colleagues on that issue of, can we get more clarity on this one?
Thank you very much, Honorable Jale. Honorable Nubu-Jakhan.
Apologies, Chair. We've just swapped interpreters. Okay. It's Honorable Nubu-Jakhan. Mr. Dupuy gave an example, and I'm thinking about an example of the post office. Perhaps the employees at the for example, at the post office are not older than 25, but the people that they serve are students, perhaps, who are younger than 25 years. So how will this affect them or affect such a situation? Because it's the public who are under the age of 25. So how do we protect them? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dupris. Even discriminating in the institutions of higher learning, there would be people who would be older than 25, who some of them might be doing their honors and masters in a university or in any other vocational training. And so this discrimination, how are we going to justify it? Mr. Dupris?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to answer the question of the post office example, and then I'm going to ask Ms. Botha to provide you with input on higher education, etc. I must admit, Mr. Chair, you were not very audible when you just raised your question. So if we don't answer your question, please excuse us, and then we can go back to your question. But with regard to the example of the post office, as the requirement stands at the moment, you will recall earlier this morning we recommended that access to or where people congregate should be removed from those definitions because it throws the net extremely wide. So the post office example would then entail that each and every employee who works directly with the public should then be vetted. But the question is then raised, does it serve any useful purpose? Because in 85% of the cases, there will only be a once-off interaction with one specific individual who falls then under the definition of paragraph B. So that would be the response to that. And of course, then one can start calculating the number of employees working countrywide for the post office. And then one really asks yourself whether all that time and money spent really served a useful purpose. But I'm going to ask Ms. Botha, with your permission, Mr. Chair, to respond to the issue around higher education. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Botha.
Thank you very much and good morning, Chair, and all the members. I thought and I hope I'm not confusing you, but insofar as the implications are concerned, if we have females under the age of 25 years in, and if we look at the example or the option that refers to higher education, just the following is, today, as of today, what the provision is, as far as I understand the Act, a principal cannot employ a teacher because the teacher is going to work with a child. And also, a teacher cannot be, or anybody else cannot be employed if that person has a sexual offence, of course, against his or her name, and that person is going to work with a mentally disabled person. That is the position as is today. What, where we are moving now is, and what my concern is, and I know it's our option, but we were just trying to help the committee and see how can we limit that persons under females under 25. I want to say is, my understanding is, if we adopt the option 3 and we adopt that first one, for instance, Roman 1, where we refer to the higher education people, let us think about it in practice. Presently, higher education, normally the people there are not children or mentally disabled people. So this is a new category. So for me, it will mean that all the lecturers that lecture to people under 25 cannot be employed by that university if their name is on the sexual offences register, which will mean if we put the act into operation, what will happen then? We sit with a lot of lecturers that have not, in my view, been vetted legally. They were not legally required to be vetted to work with the students. So for me, that is just something that we need to know, that how that will just impact on higher education. And I think the same with the service colleges as well. They don't work with children in general. They work with the females or other people under the age of 25. So the question is then, what will happen to all these lecturers who are already employed and now we insert this extra limit, requirement on the employers that they cannot employ somebody who work with children, with females under the age of 25 if they are not vetted. If I read the Act correctly, we also see that if that is the case, normally that person should be discharged immediately. So I'm just saying is, and I have in the past, I've tried to tell the committee why I think from a constitutional perspective, the people, females under the age of 25, we will be able to justify that in terms of the stats that I referred to you and the other things that I referred to you. But then the second question comes into play. In practice, what is the implications of doing that? And I just want to bring this to your attention. I don't know whether you agree with me, but for me personally, that's something that I think the committee should just take into consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we interact with what Ms. Porter has raised, can we take a 5 minutes break and come back at 25 past 10? It's a comfort break, honorable members.
Yes, Jay, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, are we back?
Yes, Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Ms. Porter. You are still on the line.
James,
what?
My name is Borges, just connecting, but may I, in the interim, just start looking at the issue. I think the point is well made by Ms. Borges that we need to be careful of unintended consequences, whilst at the same time, the focus of all our bills is to protect vulnerable females. So I understand that if a bee had have just been female under the age of 25 years, it is very broad and there could be unintended consequences when it relates to employment of such females. For example, if you have a 25-year-old applying for a position and you have a 26-year-old, the 26-year-old will probably get the position because the employer would not want to then have to re-vet all his all the people that would be working with that female. So there could be an unintended consequence when it comes to employment. I think that's a very important point we need to consider. People below the age of 25, that it could unintentionally discriminate against those persons getting jobs. When it comes to the education institutions, the point is well made that lecturers, any person working in hostels, hostel managers, people, sports instructors, cultural instructors, anyone that is employed at universities would now have to be vetted. And that would be a consequence of protecting, and we need to balance that with the consequence of protecting vulnerable females. So these are just some of the issues we grapple with. But I agree with the original submission about maybe limiting it with Roman 1, 2, and 3. And I think these are complex issues. They're not easy at all as we strive to protect vulnerable females under this particular subparagraph B. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. So for now, we can say tentatively you are covered by B.
Yes, Chair. I think that we need to just bear in mind the unintended consequence if we just left it at females under the age of 25 when it comes to accessing employment. I think they could have an unintended consequence. The point was also made about the LGBT grouping as well, of a possible unintended consequence there. So it cuts both ways. We've got to be very careful that we don't then have an employer that has this prospect of who should I employ, and then an employer might not want to employ a person who is vulnerable because of the additional cost of having to re-vet everyone. So I think that's just an consequence we need to just bear in mind. But I'm saying initially maybe we should understand this as it is as we deliberate on this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Stuart.
Chair.
Honorable Mola.
Yes, sir, I'm not sure if you saw my hand, but I think I get the actual concern and the discussion of members around the issue of certain requirements as it relates to a female under 25 years of age. But I think we should note that that only is in option 3. If you check option 1 and option 2, it's clear that it's paragraph B, female under the age of 25 years, which I think that's where the concern of members revolves around. I think it's a matter of us choosing which one is the better expression of how we want to protect these vulnerable groups. So I think let's rather opt for this kind of wording. It was the only difference with 1, 2, and 3 is that it says person who is vulnerable means. Then when you go to B, a female under the age of 25 years. But when you go to option three, it says B, female under the age of 25 years, who receives and all that and all with all the requirements. I think we do need to have the clause a female under 25 years and find a way of how do we then insert in this provision these issues of receiving without making it an option that only those who receive in terms of the Higher Education Act, in terms of the vocational training, in terms of the building, blah, blah, blah. was that's how it now appears, that a female under the age of 25 years who falls under this category. But in the previous options, it's a female under 25, which extends protection to almost all those who are under 25 years. I think that's my view, Chair of this matter. Thank you. I hope I'm audible, because I have been trying to leave the tree for the past 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah, very, very audible, Honorable Ngola. I think the challenge that we have is the issue of protection vis-a-vis the issue of unintended consequences for these people who are below the age of 25, in as far as job prospects are also concerned, is to try to find that balance. I think this is what is making us to scratch our heads now. But we have heard your point, Honorable Mona.
Excuse me, my hand is up.
Oh, Honorable Babu Msemang.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also uneasy about the age of 25. Chair, I am aware that in German law, a minor becomes an adult at 25. But in our law, the cutoff is 21. So if a person in terms of the law is an adult at 21, I don't know why we go up to 25. As Honorable Swart was saying, 25 and 26, there's very little to choose from. So I would really be happy with 21. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Baba Msema. So Baba Msema, will you be happy with 21? And then also with the limitations that have been included, for instance, under Romastica 1, 2, and 3, or will you be happy with just 25, with just 21, without these limiting sub-clauses?
Honorable Chair.
Yes, I was just saying that is a suggestion that we deal with females under the age of 21, full stop.
That is so indeed.
We don't
because
include...
it's easy to defend that. I don't think it's easy to defend 25.
Okay. So if you take the age of 21, so do we need to include Romans figure 1, 2, and 3, or we just leave it at 21? We don't try and limit it.
That's true.
Okay. Mr. Dupris, did you hear that?
Mr. Chair, I would like to respond. I would like to respond to that, Mr. Chair. First of all, in terms of the Children Act, a child is only a person under the age of 18 years. So it means that on your 18th birthday, you become an adult. Now, generally speaking, when you're 18, you also finalize grade 12. When you go and study, you study for at least between 4 to 7 years. And that is why, and that's one of the reasons why we determined it at 25. To take it back to a general requirement of a person who is under the age of 21 without restricting it, one would be faced with very similar unintended consequences that one of your other members referred to, because many young people between the ages of 18 and 21 do not necessarily go to university or study further, but they enter the job market immediately. And then I would just like to briefly mention that there's one other factor that the committee could also take into consideration when determining or discussing the unintended consequences. And that is that if, and this is maybe a response to the question raised by you earlier, Mr. Chair, where I indicated that if you include the LGBTQI community, then potential employers will have to start asking personal questions. You raised the question whether there would be any negative impact if you refuse to answer. The possible unintended consequence in that regard is that the employer, even if you are the best candidate for the job, might opt not to appoint you, because the risk of being convicted of an offence is large and rests largely on the employer, because if they don't comply with the obligations in terms of the Act, especially then it is stated in section 45(3) that if an employer does not comply with its obligations, then that employer can be convicted of an offence. So I just wanted to mention that, Chair. But Mr. Chairperson, the department, we would like to recommend that one should rather maybe focus on 25 years instead of reducing it to 21 years. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair, Wilma, Honourable Nihad Drukhan has a hand up.
Dr. Nihad Drukhan.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would also like us to keep in mind that the discussions here are not about whether the person is an adult or not. The discussion here is about vulnerable people or vulnerable person, their vulnerability. And like we've already said, you know, all women are actually vulnerable. So I'm very worried if we drop the age to 18 or even 21, you know, I would be very concerned. And I think here the discussion is a vulnerability about the woman, not the adult nature, if it's an adult or not an adult. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Nivoshtrahan, would you be happier if we leave it at 25, but with all these subsections that try to narrow the definition?
To be honest with you, Chair, I'm still considering it, because the department said, is referring to the unintended consequences. So I am still concerned about the unintended consequences. For example, if the women don't get the job, you know, because of these clauses. I'm still thinking about it. And my concern now is the unintended consequences that we've been discussing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Swartz.
Yes, could we look at the definition of employer? Is that not a possible way of limiting the scope, where we make the definition of employer slightly more limited to avoid unintended consequences? Is there any scope there? I would tend to agree with the previous speakers that we should try to stick to the age of 25, but there could be scope there. Maybe the department can look at that to try to limit unintended consequences. I'm not sure if there is any possibility there. It's quite broadly stated at this stage. But it's a complex issue, Chair. We might have to come back to it and just again deliberate on it, think about it.
Yes, I think we should, especially with respect to the issue of unintended consequences, bearing in mind that the age group we are talking about is where the level of unemployment is very high and opportunities are very limited. We have to do this balancing act very carefully. But I was looking at the definition as directed by Honorable Swart of the employer. So it means that it is only the definition of employer, it's only in the public sector. It does not, I don't see any private sector here. Am I correct?
No, Mr. Chair, if you look at, and my apologies, I didn't highlight that for you, but if you look at paragraph B, that is, paragraph A is more the public sector and paragraph B is the private sector. So we're talking about the employment sector as a whole in South Africa, Mr. Chair. And I may add, Mr. Chair, that it will be extremely difficult to reduce or to restrict the definition of employer, because you want to cover all employers. But you will recall that we discussed it earlier this morning. We said that in option two, where we could possibly bring a restriction, and that is where we start, or where the definition refers to access to, or where such persons congregate. In view of the extension of the definition of vulnerable persons, the direct recommendation to the committee during the public hearings was to consider restricting that, taking that requirement out, because then the question of whether that requirement serves any useful purpose becomes very relevant and possibly not defendable. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
I'll go back to...
So for now, we are still considering that definition of vulnerable group. We will give ourselves time to think deeply about it, given all the information that has been advanced, trying to balance the issue of protection of vulnerable groups and possible unintended consequences. We will need to come back to it later on. So can we move to the next clause?
But Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But before, can I say in the meantime, since we, after the presentation by the department, that for now, we are working on option three. We are considering all the unintended consequences in option three, without excluding other options, but we still think that option three does, to a certain extent, try to limit the damage of the unintended consequences, but we are still going to, we are still applying ourselves, as Dr. Drochens has said, that we need to give ourselves time to consider carefully the implications of this option, given the information before us. Is that fine, members?
Yes, sir.
Agreed, sir.
Thank you very much. Can we move?
We are now at the definition of sexual offence, Mr. Chair. That must be defined under the Chapter 6 to clarify which sexual offences they are. The chapter as it stands at the moment applies retrospectively to offences that were also committed for a relatively short period before the implementation of the chapter. Once again, during the public comments received by the committee, the concern was expressed in view of the fact that sexual offences against children and persons who are mentally disabled will now be extended to include all sexual offences. And you will recall on Friday, we also indicated to the committee that we would like to propose that the committee consider this option where a distinction, where it is aimed to draw a distinction between what is currently the law relating to children, and then also to ensure that as far as all the other sexual offences are concerned, they will only apply prospectively. And I would just like to note, Mr. Chair, on a technical aspect, one of your members requested us to just check the whole issue of the year of the Amendment Act. I consulted with Mr. Neil Bell, and he indicated to me that it is technically correct then, although it is a 2020 bill, to refer to it as a 2021 Amendment Act. But that situation is, of course, fluid, depending on when Parliament will approve the bill. So, Chair, I don't know whether maybe I should pause here for a moment.
Members, are we fine with the option that is before us?
Chair Swartje, I think this does cover the concerns that were expressed. I think the option is well done. It's well done to the department for that, to cover the concerns about the retrospective application. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other members?
Yes, Chair, I think I would like to concur with Honourable Swart. This has been done in a proper way that befits the provision of a national legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mola, can you privatize that spot you are in? Because I think that is the best spot. You are very audible when you are there. So we will nationalize that spot on your behalf. Don't move where you are. Just stay where you are every day.
Sure, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Can we go to the other members? Can we go to the next point? Next clause?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would just like to interrupt myself, and that is just to contribute to the discussion still to be had by the committee with regard to the possible preferred option three. The committee could be mindful of the fact, of course, that if you will recall, our option two under the definition of employer will then, of course, also positively impact in avoiding extreme unintended consequences. Just wanted to mention that one could possibly, when you consider option three, read it with option two. Thank you, Chair. Then I will proceed.
Thank you.
Chair, that brings us to the end of the definition section. And now, once again, we are in the other substantive provisions of the chapter. Those are merely, strictly speaking, consequential amendments as a result of the definitions included in section 40, and then also, of course, the extension or the expansion of the ambit of chapter 6. Now, I don't think there's too much to say apart from the fact, once again, under section 41, we do have, or we come across this phrase of having access to certain persons or where such persons are present or congregate. So we have prepared now two options for the committee to consider, and we're once again back at the issue of restricting the ambit of Chapter 6. And as in the definition of employer, option one would then be to restrict the requirements of access and congregate to children and persons with disabilities. And then, of course, a natural result of the proposal under employer, the option two, is that the department would at this stage prefer to recommend to the committee to rather consider option two more favorably. And we have also prepared then option two for you, just to indicate to you how the proposed amendments will look like. I don't know whether you want me to pause here. I think once we understand the principle is actually the same then in section 41, but I will pause here, Mr. Chair.
Members, do you want to say something?
Chair Swatia. So I think it's important that we firstly are by removing the definition of child and inserting a person who is vulnerable, that broadens it, but then the idea is to narrow it again with the access issue under the offices and access and congregation. So I think it does make sense to me. This is complex to follow, I must say. I'm sure other members are struggling as well. I'm also struggling, but I do see, so the initial idea was broadening to cover all people who are vulnerable, considering our discussions around that, but then to try to narrow it a little bit by looking at the issues of the access and the congregate.
Okay. Other views? Okay, let's proceed, Mr. Dupris.
Chair, should we indicate just an idea that could be our preference at this stage, the option two?
Yes. Where there is no objection, we will take it that it is our preference for now until we come back if there are other options, but this is part of the working document. We're still going to come back to this clause in our next meeting. Can we proceed, Mr. Dupris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, what I wanted to say is I apologize for not being able to explain this clearly to the committee members, but once again, I would like to pause just for a moment at section 41 and explain the impact by way of a short example of access to. If I am a member of a sport club and I play cricket at a cricket club, I will have access to children if there's a children's team. So that means, strictly speaking, per definition, I will have to be vetted before I can become a member or even an employee of that sport club. Now, when the comments were made to the committee, the commentator said it's that wide requirement is understandable when it comes to children and persons who are mentally disabled. But as soon as you extend the ambit by means of the definition of person who is vulnerable, then once again, the question of that useful purpose then arises. I thought I might just mention that, Mr. Chair. I will proceed, Mr. Chair. There's not...
So, Mr. Dupris, although it might not be, maybe it might be an issue of regulations, that what is going to be involved in that voting?
Because sorry, Chair, what is going?
What is going to be involved in that voting process so that we, at least a potential employer, must know and try and organize his or her resources as such. I know it might be a little bit early, maybe it might be something that might be included in the regulations, but generally what would be involved there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the regulations provide for applications to the National Register for Sex Offenders to be issued with a certificate stating whether the particulars of an individual have been included in the register or not. Now, what would be required is that someone who wants to apply for a job must then, of course, be required to submit that certificate in order to prove that he or she has not been convicted of a sexual offence against a child or a person who is mentally disabled. That is currently the position. Practically, it would mean that some job applications might be delayed and that one might possibly even miss out on the opportunity of being employed. It all depends on what the turnaround time is for issuing those certificates. But that, in short, is the requirements currently. There are also prescribed forms that must be filled in and certain information to be provided either by the potential employee or then, of course, the employer with regard to existing employees. May I proceed, Chair?
Yes. Just the point of before. I was not aware. I think that is a thank you for that question. I'm just hearing that Mr. Dupree says these people normally are the ones who are bringing these certificates. So I just, something that came to me, Chad, that says that brought a consent that in this corruption, in this time of corruption, how is the employer going to be making sure that that certificate is legit? It's just a thought that came to me. If this has been the procedure that has been happening, as he was just mentioning, my concern was just that one, that in this corruption world that we are living in, the certificate that will be coming with the very same person that we are vetting, is it really a good thing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Mr. Dupress?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to give an indirect answer because I'm not okay with how the registrar's certificates look like. But what I might add at this early stage, because we are going to get to it later in the document, is that the police clearance certificate is an authentic certificate. They go to certain lengths to be in a position to issue a certificate, knowing that it would be very hard to falsify that certificate. But Mr. Chair, honestly, and I must admit, I'm not sure how the physical certificate that the registrar issues looks like. May I proceed, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Dupress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, under Section 42, we have already indicated to the committee the proposed amendments there, and under sub 4, there's a number of options there, and that relates to making information publicly available. However, when we started working on the options in an attempt to protect the identity of persons who were children at the time of the commission of the offence, and then also importantly enough to protect the identity of the children who were victims of perpetrators, the inevitable conclusion here is that if you are actually restricting or diluting the information contained in the register, so you are most probably going to make much less information of perpetrators available that are actually on the register. And usually one thinks of where you want to protect the identity of the child victim or the person who was mentally disabled, that is actually the more serious offences that were committed. So under sub one, the attempt was then, option one, the attempt was to say that certain details must be made publicly available, but then at the same time attempt to restrict for purposes of protecting the identity of children. And then we also have the option two, where a slightly different approach is proposed, where any person may be allowed to apply in order to establish or determine whether a particular person's particulars have been included in the register. Mr. Chair, you will recall that on Friday's meeting, the committee requested us to provide additional options here in view of the fact that Dr. Lutz briefly referred to the system in Kenya. Now, we have done research, Mr. Chair, but for purposes of preparing options, it became evident to us very early that the Kenyan system, we also had a look at the Nigerian system, and we also had a look at the Canadian system. Those systems differ primarily in one important aspect from our register as it stands now, and that is that those registers are usually tools, first of all, for police to conduct certain investigations, and then, for example, in the Kenya example, their register is primarily used, or let me take one step backwards. In Kenya, if you are convicted of a sexual offense against a child, a person who is mentally disabled, or an old person, then the court must declare you a dangerous sexual offender. And then that has certain consequences, among others, that their Department of Correctional Services must, after your release from prison, monitor the individual concerned, and also, of course, it enables the police to conduct investigations accordingly. So at this stage, Mr. Chair, we were not able to really learn that much from those systems in order to come up with an alternative proposal here. So I don't know whether the committee would like to give us a bit more guidance. But as I said, the South African system works a bit different than the other systems which we had a look at.
Before you proceed, the options that are before us now, have they dealt with the issue of constitutionality?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the option one, you will recall that in the committee expressed a concern about possible identity theft, and that is why one restricts it to the first 8 digits of the identity number in that option. But there's always that inherent risk, Mr. Chair. Let's say, for example, you take my full names and my surname, which is if I may say, a name and first names and a surname that occurs a lot in this country, there might be a very strong possibility that a person with exactly the same first names and surname as myself might appear on the register. And if that information is made available, one is always concerned that I, as an individual, might be confused with someone else, and I might even suffer damage as a result thereof. So there are those inevitable risks involved in making the information publicly available. And then the question is also, of course, what would be the purpose? Should there be a purpose statement for making the information publicly available, or would anyone willy-nilly be able to go to the registrar and find out whether an individual's particulars appear on the register? There are indeed risks involved in making the information publicly available. And if I recall correctly, Dr. Lewis, at a previous meeting of the committee, also took some time to highlight those risks in her written submission to the committee regarding the public availability of information. And I might just add also, Mr. Chair, that the countries that we have a look at, their registers are not publicly available. It's strictly speaking only for investigative purposes by their police forces.
I think the big question to members would be whether in principle do we agree that anyone can have access to that information, or should that information be restricted to the employers of the person who is going to be employed? But I think the big question is whether, as a committee, do we agree that that information should be made publicly available or should be online? I think that is the big question, because that is what is going to guide the drafting of the clause itself. Bearing in mind the issues that Dr. Lutz raised, possible issues of vigilantism, possible attacks on the next of kin of the person who might be deemed to be a perpetrator, and how do we ensure that we protect the public, but ensuring that the information about the alleged person is available for the purpose of ensuring that people do not employ people who would be a risk to the company or to the vulnerable groups, but whilst at the same time ensuring that we don't run a risk of passing something that is going to be unconstitutional. Members?
Chairperson?
Mamuna Matem?
Let me just find out, in line with your question, I want to find out to the team, what were the implications, maybe the imperative sense of the Constitution, if indeed the committee, for example, agree that that issue, and I mean to say we publicize the register, what? Because I'll tell you what, this is a very difficult issue. Everybody, one way or the other, one person or persons are going to be impacted. But I think in this case, if I was in a position of a person who was involved, who was sexually molested or abused, Chairperson, if I put myself in that position, maybe out of anger or emotion, I would say publicize that person so that the details of that person, so that he does not repeat that again. I'm talking from the point of view of a person who was involved, who maybe one way or the other, his life has been destroyed by that act. So my question is only on the issue of the constitutionality of publicizing this thing. Is there maybe anything that we are tapping that will put us in trouble in terms of the context, in line with your question, Chair? Thank you.
In addition to your question, Honorable Chair, will it be correct for the legislators just to legislate purely on the basis of anger? Anger of the victims, or the duty of the legislators is to ensure that everybody's rights are balanced out to ensure that we have a workable legal system. Because we do have, it's a sensitive situation, we do have situations where sometimes victims, out of bitterness, can sometimes also be perpetrators. Should we not be saying that as legislators, we are going to take into consideration everybody's interest and have a legislation that is going to ensure that at the end of the day, rights of everybody are protected? I'm just adding to your question, Mamunoma Tem.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask, with your permission, if Dr. Lewis would also like to mention something in this regard, but I think your questions actually summarize the whole concern and actually speak for themselves. I think that is the bottom line. The part of your question is extremely important, and I think that is the bottom line. You've summarized it by saying, is it proper for the legislature to legislate in anger? And that is the whole issue of justification. And I agree with you, Chair. One must be extremely careful here. Back to the question, will this publicly available information serve any useful purpose? The Law Reform Commission, when they came out with their report, they actually reported against making information publicly available. And one of the questions that they raised is, what is the purpose that will be served? And there's no conclusive evidence that making a person's particulars available on a register will bring about a reduction in persons committing offences again. There's even anecdotal information that indicates that there might even be an increase in repeat offending. But Chair, I'm going to ask the assistance of Dr. Lewis if she would like to maybe contribute to this answering this question.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members. With your permission, Chair, if I can add to that. Chair?
Yes, well,
thank you. Chair, I think the points raised by yourself and the members with regard to legislating in anger is a very good point to start at, because when you limit a right, and there are quite a few rights, as we discussed earlier, that can be affected by the publication on a website of the information, you require a legitimate governmental purpose. There needs to be something that can justify a negative impact. And anger I can't see any instance in where a court would go, the general anger of a nation is enough to take away or not balance that properly. I think that how I understand the concerns that the provision is trying to balance is that the community and people want to know that there is a way for them to feel protected and be protected. If I can ask just to go a little bit down to option two with permission, Chair. There it says that any person may apply in a prescribed form for that information. So if we go with an option like that, there's still a way for the public to get the information if it is justified in the circumstances, and that will make somebody protect themselves and while also respecting the rights of others. So I think there's a less restrictive way, a more constitutional way in a approach like option two, to steer away from the unconstitutionality. I can't myself, from how I understand the Constitution, see that the Constitutional Court would say making information public just because will not be unconstitutional. I have a very, very real concern, even with option one in restricting the ID digits, because people, when they were at like the honourable member says, react out of anger. You just say stuff and publish stuff, and yes, you can retract it, but the damage done is irreversible to somebody. If that person is not the sexual offender, that damage done to their reputation, the possibility of them getting employment, to their family and their kids, it's not something you can actually give back to somebody. You can give them a monetary damage, but you can't give back what they've lost. So option two for me is the most balanced, like, middle ground, walking that middle ground between the public interest and protecting the public as well as respecting the rights of all persons. I do acknowledge that with that option, there is a need, perhaps this could be done in regulations. A colleague from the DOJ could assist here, because you have the option of, you need to distinguish between when an employer then asks the register for information and when a person with an interest asks the register for information, that the employer doesn't sidestep that process by merely like putting in an application for somebody who has an interest. So perhaps through regulations and the forms and that can be distinguished. But I think the roots of, like we said, the UK, Kenya, all of those, their registers are closed. But there is ways of protecting the public through such an request and application process. So just from my point of view, I think option two is the most safe option. I don't think option one, or as it was tabled, will pass constitutional scrutiny.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ramos. Honorable Mfokeng, followed by Honorable Swart.
Hey, I think I do understand Honorable Dr. Lewis, but my question will be, how many times did we talk about the regulations that are supposed to be done by the department and they don't happen? Then in that case, what is it that we should do with immediate effect immediately after passing the law, that the regulations must have a time frame to be set in place, because most of the time the regulations are never implemented or are never even drafted. They are left like that. That is actually what I'm trying to say, that we should look at that. I don't disagree with her at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mfokeng. We can either put it in the legislation or as part of our oversight, we give them or to a resolution of the House that maybe we give within a certain period or within 6 months or a year, the regulations must be developed. And if we want to that the House, or in this case, the committee, must have a say in the regulations, we can put it in the legislation that those regulations can be passed after having been seen by us. And there are legislations that ensures that regulations developed by the executives are still conferred or concurred by the House or by the committee. But it would be important that the issue raised by Honorable Mfokeng, because it's dealt with, we don't give power to the executive to develop regulations without giving them a time frame. But we also ensure that those regulations will come back to us before they are enforced. I'm not sure whether does that cover you, Honorable Mfokeng?
Chair, it does cover me, because it's also very clear that for those people that would want the registrar to be public, as we are explaining in terms of the law and the constitution, it can happen. But at the moment, you look at almost all the cases in court, we see the faces daily. And I think that is something that the communities, the organizations, is where maybe they can capitalize on that, to cut these articles and put them in their offices to show the history. Because it's also very important that when something is happening to Tshegofatso Pule now, I will cut that piece and actually put it on the side for education in my area, because some of the information does go missing. But for me, I will keep it in my office, but others might not know. And it's very important that as much as it will be difficult, but let us record those that are in public space now. And that is how we can work it out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But you have no problem with option two?
No, I'm happy with it. Hence, I decided to add on the issue of regulations, and I'm glad that the time frames will assist everyone.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Honorable Mfokeng. Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I think those the arguments in favor of option two are quite compelling. Dr. Lewis and others, Mr. Dupreka, I do have a concern about the broadness, as it is not about the option, but without that option, just as it, if it was relating to the names and the 8 digits of the ID, I think that can rise to victimization and vigilantism and even confusion, where you have names and those names are published. So I do think that the option two is preferable. I think that it is also that clearly the section would not kick in until the regulations are drafted. So I do agree with the issue relating to the time frame for the regulations. And we'd have to look at the regulations throughout the amendment bill as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart.
Chair, Honorable Nyo Drukhan has a hand up.
Dr. Nyo Drukhan.
Thank you very much, Chair. My concern in option two is that it says somewhere there, I'm just scanning the document, in Roman figure two, it says a child is a complainant but with a mental disability. What about, or a mental disability? What about when the person can't express themselves vocally? I mean, not only deafness, but there are other disabilities like cerebral palsy, where people cannot express themselves vocally. So we just need to add that in consideration, because that can be exploited. You know, if a person, you know, if someone knows that, you know, this victim can't speak for themselves, and then it can, that situation can be exploited. So if we can just look at that a bit deeper. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nibot-Johans. That would be considered. Mr. Dupris, Dr. Lourdes, and Ms. Porter.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know whether Ms. Porter would like to add something, but just with regard to the last question, Mr. Chair, and this question was raised previously, but when we use the term child, it's an all-inclusive definition, irrespective of the mental health or the intellectual ability or the physical ability of the child. I'll stop there. Thank you, Chair. I don't know whether Dr. Lewis would like to add something.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I see the argument that Advocate Dupree is making. I mean, if the committee wants to reflect on it, just reading it now, I see where they're coming from, and I also see where the question falls. But I can't really shoot from the hip on this one. But yeah, the argument from the department makes sense. One could possibly just, I don't clarify it more, but this is me being very, very risque. And yeah, like I said, I don't really want to shoot from the hip on this.
Okay, no, that's fine, Dr. Lutz. Ms. Porter, do you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, no. She indicated that she's fine. She don't want to add anything. Okay. I don't know whether you want me to proceed, Mr. Chair, but there's one other thing that I would just like to mention for the committee. Although option two is now the preferred option, we must note the proposal in five. And that is, if you have access to the information that the registrar provided to you, there is, of course, a confidentiality obligation resting on you. And if you transgress that, then you will be guilty of an offence. What I've heard from the discussion now, I don't know, we'll have to receive, I don't know whether this proposed sub 4 and 5 will be sufficient. One might have to take it a bit further. But once again, we'll wait for the committee possibly to come back with us with their final conclusions. With your permission, I'll proceed then, Mr. Chair.
Before you proceed, to take it a bit further by doing what?
Beg your pardon, Chair?
You say that you don't know whether you can take this thing a bit further. I was saying that you wanted to take it a bit further by doing what? Or what do you want to insert?
Well, Chair, it all depends on what the committee would want. You see, my concern at this stage is not necessarily... It's difficult. Chair, I just need to check whether proposed 4 and proposed 5 would be sufficient to slot in or to gel with the other provisions of Chapter 6, because we're actually creating two separate procedures now. The one procedure for an individual, which is fairly easy to comply with, vis-a-vis the procedure being created for employers, which is arguably a bit more onerous. The question arises, why should an employer go through the application process to the registrar when an employer simply can also, as a member of the public, use sub 4 in order to determine whether proposed employee has been convicted of sexual offences or not. So it's all a question of, it might be a technical question, but it still does arise whether these two sub-provisions slot in properly with the other requirements contained in Chapter 6.
Okay, we'll come back to it.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, and I'm speaking on a correction. We've highlighted these two provisions to the committee on Friday. It didn't solicit any discussion. Maybe just to get an indication from the committee whether the committee is satisfied with this, then I can also start cleaning up the document in that regard. But I got the notion that the committee is satisfied with the proposed new sections 44 capital B and 44 capital C.
Members, are you still satisfied as you were on Friday?
Yes, Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other members?
Yes, Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much. Proceed, Mr. Swart, Mr. Dupre, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Just making a quick note for myself. Yes, Mr. Chair, then I think the remainder of these provisions or the proposed amendments speak for themselves that we have discussed previously. It didn't really solicit any comments or criticism or questions. That then nearly brings us to the end of the first part of our working document. And you will recall that the second part of our working document relates to the proposal that the South African Police Services, the Criminal Record Center of SAPS, should then take over the functions of confirming whether a person has been convicted of a sexual offence or not. Mr. Chair, yes, apologies, I'm interrupting myself. When it comes to, this is a transitional provision which provided, this is the provision that was introduced in the bill, and it provided that if persons who have qualified for the removal of their particulars before the implementation of the Act, then they should have done so before it has been implemented. But during the Portfolio Committee public comment stage, it was indicated to us that that would not be a fair process to follow, and it would be more appropriate to say that any person who has qualified for removal before the Amendment Act came into operation should be able to do so if he or she has not applied for it beforehand. So in other words, that they would still be allowed to apply for that after the implementation of the Act. And the department supports this proposal, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether the committee might be in a position to provide us with a final indication whether it prefers the option or not, but we strongly recommend the option, Chair.
Members?
Yeah. That's it, I think.
Chair, I'm satisfied with the option as proposed by the department from my side.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart. Other members? Okay. Honorable Mufuke. One
is looking at this and agreeing with that, but we should also be mindful of what was said by those that made submissions. Others wanted it to be a lifetime, you know, thing that the person must belong to the register, which at the same time is unconstitutional. But I was just saying that we should be mindful of that was also there, that information. Thanks.
Thank you very much. The lifetime would be unconstitutional. What is the maximum time that Mr. Lucas?
Mr. Chair, if a person has been convicted, and this is what this provision is all about, if a person has been convicted of two or more sexual offences, now currently, of course, against children or persons who are mentally disabled, their particulars may not be removed from the register. However, Romans 1, 2, and 3 provides an indication of the period in terms of which a person's particulars must be remain on the register. And the proposal was, or the request was, that those periods are not long enough, and the request was made for those periods to be, well, strictly speaking, doubled. But it all depends on the offense that was committed, and then, of course, the sentence that was imposed in order to determine how long a person's particulars must remain on the register. The provision is there in toto, so it would not be necessary for members to go back to the Principal Act to see what the time periods are. But the bottom line is, Chair, if you've been convicted of two or more, your particulars may not be removed from the register.
Okay. Chairperson?
Honorable Mufuke?
I think one is happy when you look at, I think it's, Dr. Lewis, can you go? Yes. If you look at number one, it makes it, explains it very well. But then the question that will follow will be, if a person should, on going to other subsection, if a person should be applying for the removal, are those people or perpetrators or affected families or organizations, will they be contacted? I'm asking this question because, remember, it has been one of those thorny issues when it comes to parole, you know. And for a person to be removed from that, it goes the same way. Are they going to be consulted to hear? Are they happy? Are they, what is it, you know? Because this person has made a damage to the society. What can I be advised? What will be the process? Because if then there should be a process, we should be told that there will be regulations in this regard. We should not just say people will apply and the next thing people will complain to say a person is out, because our people will forget that it's 20 years is done or it's 14 years. It will be like, you see, they released a person. Those are things that we should be mindful of, our ordinary people and how they view things. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mufuke. Mr. Dupres?
Mr. Chair, I'm becoming tired. Would you be willing to ask me easier questions to answer, please?
I can imagine. Can you imagine?
Mr. Chair, this is an extremely difficult question to answer, and one wouldn't want to be too long-winded, but we must remind ourselves what the purpose of Chapter 6 is. And Chapter 6 is not... It is about the employment relationship, first of all. It's not, strictly speaking, about the victim. It's about the potential victim. It's a safety mechanism that the legislature wanted to introduce to protect other persons. One of the very first questions that always arise when one starts talking about a register for sex offenders is the question of punishment. The question is always, let's say, for example, my particulars have been included in the register, but I was sentenced to jail for 5 years imprisonment. When I came out, the theory of punishment is I served my punishment. I shouldn't be punished anymore. I should be taken up into the community and rehabilitated. So that very first sort of, one might say, philosophical question is, but it's a very real question to answer, is, aren't you adding to the punishment of a person? But once again, one would not be, when the victim is involved in making statements on the early release of a person or not, that is the victim. That is an existing system where that person is still serving his or her punishment. But when it comes to the register, the aim, the purpose is a bit different. And that is to have the focus on the potential victims. And that is why the legislature introduced these protective measures. I must admit, I can't remember when these provisions were drafted, whether victim impact statements, etc., were discussed or debated. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I only see flowers now.
Chairperson? Mr. Dupree, I can see that the chairperson is not on the chair, but maybe I should take a, but I think it was going to be directed to the chairperson because it's for the future after you have explained that maybe we are learning from this that education will be very important. Okay, here's the chair. Chairperson, unfortunately, we could see that you are not on the chair. Thank you very much. Can I make a follow-up? Oh, yes, we realize that we are out of your space. It's okay. Chair, I was saying that...
I'm sorry, honorable members. Sometimes it's difficult to keep on asking for breaks. We have some conditions, some of us, but you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. You just say that I'm going where nobody can ask me, why should I go there? Thank you. Nobody can go for you. Chair, I was saying that with the explanation of Mr. Dupree, it's very important that we should be mindful of what he was explaining with our history and experiences out there, that it means the department must invest in education. After this, when it has passed, education will be important to all the people that are working with the, going to be working with this, to say that don't take people for granted. Let us educate and educate generation and generation. That will be important. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mfuklang. Other members? None. Can we proceed?
Before you proceed, no, I wanted just on a lighter note to comment and say, no, you are forgiven. Just like Mr. Dupree is forgiven for just telling us that it's a difficult question.
Yes, the former president, Mutante, he would often say that. Even as a president, there are certain things you'll never be able to delegate in life. And that is one of them. Thank you very much, Mr. Dupris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, yes, we've discussed this option. We got the indication that the committee likes this option. There's not much, those are consequential amendments. There's just a technical amendment that we need to effect. We've already indicated that to the committee on Friday. We just need to amend the long title of the act. Then, yes, and also the index to the act. Clause 21 is our short title and commencement provision. Mr. Chair, if I may ask, I must admit, I don't know how the committee's program looks like today. I don't know whether we are restricted in time, but I would like to start with this part of the document, and I would like to finish it. So if you could possibly just indicate to me, please, Mr. Chair, how long we have to do that. I would just like to get a sense of how I should pace myself.
And now it's 10 to 12. We can go up to 1:30 because the half starts at 2. And most of the members would be debating in the house. So maximum, I think it will be until 2:30. When is the house rising? At what time is the house rising? Committee Secretary? If we are not done...
Yes, sir, I'm just checking.
Yes, if we are not done by 1:30, maybe we can come back after the house has risen. But I do understand that members from Gauteng would also be having the Yale Khotla after from 7:00. So if we can be done by that time, it would be better. But let's check between now and 1:30. Between now and 1:30, how far we can go. Honorable Jelle?
Okay.
Mufuke?
Thank you, Chair. I think one will agree that we can go until 1:30, but the challenge will be if you say immediately after the house sitting, some of us have to travel from the parliament to our villages. So it will be difficult to join you, but with your permission, I can allow those that are on the platform to continue.
Or maybe, Honorable Mfuke, maybe let's stick to the program because we're supposed to come back also on Friday after the subcommittee meeting at 2 to deal with the sexual offenses. Maybe from today, if we don't finish, we will come back on Friday to finalize the second part. Maybe let's do it like that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's try and see how far we can push, Mr. Dupris.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to do my utmost best to run through this in time. And I think it will be possible because I think there are two or three very important questions. What this part is all about is the question whether the functions of informing a person, whether an individual has a previous conviction or not, should be transferred to the South African Police Service Criminal Record Center. Now, what we have done in this part, and we've already explained that to you, Mr. Chair, is that we've indicated the amendments that would be required to achieve that goal. Now, what we would like to indicate, and I think there was a slight misunderstanding on Friday when we debated the whole issue whether the criminal record center, the certificate to be issued by them, should be restricted to sexual offenses or should reflect all the offenses. Now, what I have neglected to indicate to you, Chair, and once again, I apologize for that because I think that is where the misunderstanding arose, is a police clearance certificate reflects all the convictions or all the offenses that you were convicted of. It is not necessary for purposes of this part to restrict a police clearance certificate to only sexual offenses. First of all, it will create a bit of problems for SAPS because they will have to change their systems. But what we were trying to say is that if you request an ordinary police clearance certificate, it will reflect all the offenses that you have been convicted of. And if you prohibit a person from working with, for example, children who has any type of offense, then we are going beyond the ambit of the Act. What we actually wanted to propose, Mr. Chair, is that where we have the prohibitions, and I'm just going, maybe I should just take you to an example then. If you have the prohibition to work with children, that could and that should still be restricted to persons who have been convicted of sexual offenses, although the police clearance certificate will indicate all the offenses that you have been convicted of. The prohibition, for example, in section 41 of the Act, will be restricted to sexual offenses, and that will place our amended provisions still within the ambit of the Act. So that is actually the one big question that the committee will have to answer. And the other one is, of course, whether the South African Police Service Criminal Record Center should take over the functions. If they issue certificates as they do now, reflecting all the offences, then it's business as usual, with the exception that they might need additional personnel in order to address the volume, the increase in volume of requests for clearance certificates. Currently, they process about, it was indicated to us, 1 million certificates, or they issue 1 million certificates per year. And then, of course, I could possibly also then mention again the Criminal Record Center, the clearance certificate system is the only real positive identification that you have of an individual, because they do a search of previous convictions against your biometrics, namely your fingerprints. So that is the most effective system to record criminal records. I think those are the two important questions, and I think it speaks for itself, without trying to influence the committee, that a clearance certificate could be issued reflecting all the convictions. That would amount to business as usual for the Criminal Record Center. But in Chapter 6, the restriction to employ will then still remain with regard to sexual offences having been committed against vulnerable persons. I think you must. Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Gwita would just like to interrupt me for a moment with your permission, please.
I'm sorry, Chair. I just want to inform the committee that after our meeting on Friday, we did speak to the SAPS people and Brigadier Van Rooyen, who previously attended one of our meetings, and I told them that of the concerns of the committee is to say that whether they will be ready to take over, and if not, did they budget, or will they be able, what is the cost implications? I discussed it with her. I don't know whether they are also listening in, and I was just wondering whether they cannot firsthand maybe also enlighten the committee about what is required here, because also of the concerns that have been raised that, you know, if you want to pass on, there's a law and you need to make regulations and it's never made. We want to make sure that if the committee feels that the register must be almost like stopped and all the things will go to police, I think it's important that if they are listening in, that they just give you an idea also of how it will affect them. And not to say that we mustn't go that option, but that the committee is fully aware of how they will be affected. Thank you very much.
Ms. Boda, is the Brigadier a decision maker in such?
I spoke to her, and the Brigadier indicates that she will have to speak to the people from the Record Centre, as well as try to get their minister's views, because you remember the whole issue of whether this register must go to SAPS was not in the bill as introduced and as approved by Cabinet. So it's like an important policy shift that we are dealing with here, and I would not like, just from Justice's side, we can say how we can deal with the bill. But I thought that it would be very useful for the committee also to hear what the police have to say.
Is SAPS in the meeting? They seem not to be in the meeting, Ms. Porter.
This morning I just spoke to Mr. Romano and just indicated to him that because of the concerns raised on Friday by the committee, we did immediately after our meeting engage with the police to make them aware of the, you know, the questions that were raised and the issues about the money and so forth, and I asked him whether it's possible just for them to send to them also an invitation so that they can listen in and they hear where we are going with this thing. So he said that he will send an invitation to them, but I can't see whether they are here as participants, Jay.
They seem not to be here. And I am concerned that we might be speaking to people who are not decision makers, who themselves still need to consult further. But let me hear the views of other members.
Swartz, yeah?
Honorable Swartz?
No, Chair, I think your concerns are well placed. Whilst we welcome the attempts to get clarity on this issue, I think this is, as well, first, it's not a new issue. This has been discussed for some time, but I do think that there would be some political engagement necessary. Bearing in mind, however, that the bill is now with Parliament. So So I'm not sure whether one should. This is a, and the point that was made is this is a policy shift that did not go via the bill as passed by cabinet. I think that we would need to clarify this issue, but given the urgency, this could be an issue as well. If there are concerns, it could be dealt with in the NCOP level when the bill is dealt with by them. But I wanted to just raise the one issue, and that is if the registrar, if the intention is to basically pass on the function of the existing registrar to the SAPs, then those funds that are presently funding the registrar should possibly go to the SAPs to assist them. I would think that you know, the funding follows function. But I think that from a policy perspective, you might, I'm not sure how we, because this is a significant shift. It's not the first time these things have happened where the legislature decides Parliament needs to do this. But clearly, I think that at the end of the day, it's always important that any bill that is passed, we need to know what the costing is going to be, because that's obviously when we pass good legislation and it's not implemented due to financial constraints. So I think you have very well articulated the issue here as to the policy and the need, the urgent need to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Swart, other members.
Chair, may I just add something?
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I was supposed to do an interview for 3 minutes. Can you just break for 3 minutes?
Agreed, Chair.
Thank you.
Hello.
Chair. You concerning the report on the public protector. They asked for 3 minutes, but you know how radio stations operate. But thank you very much for agreeing that we take this break to address other issues. So Dr. Dupriez, you are still on the floor?
It's just thank you, Priya, Mr. Chair, it's not Dr.
Based on the powers given to me by the National Assembly, I now confirm the degree of doctorate to Mr. Dupriez.
And the difficult questions, he needs a PhD to answer them.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think those are the two very important questions to be raised. When it comes to this part of the document, this part of the document, insofar as vulnerable persons are concerned and the definition of employer and the remaining provisions, are very similar to the proposed amendments in the first part of the document, except that there are a lot of provisions, clauses, sections that will be omitted, and it is clearly indicated there to the committee. So at this stage, I'm running through the document, and I know that I want to get to one point that was raised on Friday, but while I'm running through the document, maybe just to indicate to the committee that what we have discussed also appears here. So it's not something new. So at this stage, with regard to this part of the document, two important questions. Should the Criminal Record Center take over the functions of issuing, well, actually nothing else than clearance certificates? And the other question is, the prohibitions here should then be restricted to the sexual offences. That will keep us within the ambit of Chapter 6. On Friday, one of your committee members raised the question whether it would not be possible to determine a date on which the functions should be transferred to the Criminal Record Center. And I had a look at this very last provision, the transitional provision that we have included in the bill. And I want to run to that with your permission, Chair. I want to close to the end. Here's the transitional provision then on page 45 of our document. And you will recall that I've expressed doubts about the usefulness of the provision on Friday, Mr. Chair, but that was, and I explained it to you, it was just when I had to look at the provision again, I just asked myself, what are we actually doing here? But I had an opportunity to discuss it with SAPS, and they indicated that a provision like this would be important if the functions are transferred to the Criminal Record Center in the first instance. But this provision also poses a solution to the question raised by one of your members, whether it would be possible to make provision for a future transfer. And that is precisely because of the fact that this provision determines that up to the stage where this Amendment Act is implemented, the obligation will rest on the minister to transfer the database of the registrar to the National Commissioner of SAPS, and then also the information that the registrar receives during this period will then also be referred to the National Commissioner on an ad hoc or as and when necessary basis. Chair, we have gone through the provisions on Friday. I don't know whether there's anything else that you would like me to highlight. And I'm going to ask Ms. Botha, with your permission, Chair, just to address the committee.
Before,
yes, Chair.
Can you go down? You are talking about the minister who, in terms of the transitional arrangements, we transfer, yes, the minister must, before the commencement of the criminal law, sexual offences and related matters amendment, transfer the database in his or her registrar's custody to the National Commissioner. In this case, which minister? Is it the minister responsible for justice or the minister of police?
Yes, thank you, Chair. It's the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, because the minister, the term minister is defined in Section 1 of the Act. So it's our minister, the Minister of Justice. And the reason why we propose that it should be the minister rather than the registrar, because Chapter 6 places the obligation on the minister to establish the register. So it would be technically more correct then to place that obligation on the minister, Mr. Chair.
Can a minister of another department transfer functions to an official of a department that does not belong to his or her authority? Will it
yes, make- Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sorry, Chair. No, I think I interrupted you. I think you wanted to finish your question. Sorry, Chair.
Yes. Will it make proper governance sense for a minister in one department to be allowed to transfer functions to an official of another department that does not belong to her or him?
Mr. Thank you, Chair. I discussed that with SAPS And I actually asked their advice because I raised exactly the same question. The response that I got was that they don't really see a problem with that because it's not a question of, it's not a two-way interaction. It's merely the minister referring a database or to the national commissioner. But what we can do, Mr. Chair, we can rephrase that provision for you if you're concerned about that, and we could possibly just place the obligation on the minister to, by saying the minister must ensure that the information, that the database be referred. Then the minister can, for example, either request the registrar or even the DG of Justice to transfer the database to the National Commissioner. So we'll be guided by you, Mr. Chair. We don't feel strongly the one or the other way. It's merely to ensure that information is transferred.
What is the view of other members? Is somebody speaking, Mr. Dupris, next to you?
Sorry, Chair, it's Ms. Buerta. She just indicated to me that, but I think we've already indicated to you that we would like to request her, with your permission, just to address the committee on another point.
Let's first finish this issue before we go to the next point. Yes. Members, are we happy with this response with respect to transitional provisions, 52(a)?
Chair, I think after your question and the explanation for me, I think it's valid.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Mpuke. I don't see any other hand. Can we go to Ms. Botha?
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, for this opportunity. I thought I just wanted to bring to the attention of the committee a question that has come to my mind, and I think that's a very important question just to think about, not to say that for that reason the committee can't decide that the register must go to the SAP. I want to take you back to the section that Hank dealt with, Mr. Priya dealt with, when we were talking about the removal of the names of the persons on the register. You will remember that as it stands now, if somebody is found guilty, his or her name is entered on the register, and then there's this provision that says, if you behave nicely and you don't do naughty things, then after 5, 7 or how many years, depending on what the offense was, your name will be removed from the register. Now, the way I see that removal is like an automatic removal. There's no decision making in the registrar. The only thing is, if this person was again found guilty, it's without saying that, then that person's application for removal will be refused. But in the normal sense of the word, there's this legitimate expectation, this is how I see it, that has been raised by this register, and the fact that if you behave properly, that your name will be removed. What is the consequences if my name is removed? The consequence is that then I will be able to become a teacher because that prohibition is then no longer applicable to me. Now, if you look at then the system, if we give it over to the police, the purpose of the giving over of the register to the police is not to go on and have a register. It is actually just for transitional provisions so that they also can see whose names are there. But that means the removal of the names on the register, that provision, the committee will have to think about what will happen to that, or will it be a sense of we're going to remove that as well, and then what the person must do in order to get his name clear is to go through the pardon process, which is a complete different process. And I was just thinking, and I don't know whether Professor or Dr. Lewis has a specific view on the issue of legitimate expectation raised by this provision, and what will happen then if there is no register, so to speak, anymore, and we work only on the SAP 69. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we should link your question to the question earlier raised by Honorable Mfokeng as to what would be the process vis-a-vis the legitimate expectation with regard to also the victims, whether the victims would be consulted or not when a person apply for his or her name to be removed from the register. I do think that maybe Dr. Lewis can respond, or it's something that we must also keep it at the back of our mind when we come back to this issue, to say how is that process going to be managed? Is it going to be just a purely administrative process, or there has to be a form of a process that ensures that the victims are also consulted, and what would be the unintended consequences of that should we agree to that? I'm not sure whether Honorable Mfokeng, did I capture your concerns?
Yes, Chair, you did very well. Because if you can think about it, it goes even beyond that we have experience of certain things in departments where people have to be maybe applying or being removed from the system, whatever criminal. And you find that when they check, I remember there was a case, they found that somebody was released. Actually, the criminal records were removed and they were not supposed to, but they couldn't trace who did that. Then it goes further into say the system should be able to talk so that we know that it's Magwanishi who was the person who dealt with that application before it was referred to the person who authorizes it. Because this thing of our public service that one works on something, if a person makes a mistake, a person sometimes resign, you cannot trace or follow that person, and there should be consequence management. That should be the same. Not one person, not two, but there should be something that shows us that the process is done and it's public.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lewis?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Chair, this is very dangerous territory for me in the capacity of the mandate of our office. The route that needs to be followed is very much a policy decision, and then once such decision is made, then one can interrogate the processes for me to comment on what a decision that will clearly impact on the workings of two different departments and their powers and responsibility in the administration. I don't think I have the mandate or the knowledge to comment on that. Once such a decision is made, such a policy decision is made, I will very gladly help the department with anything or checking anything legally or drafting wise. But I'm not the best situated to comment on what the best choice will be in this instance.
Very much, Dr. Lutz. No, we will not see you. But I do think that these are some of the things that we should keep them at the back of our mind, so that when we come back maybe Friday these are some of the areas that we should try and deal with. We are raising so that we are raising them so that we are able to think through them. Before the bill is passed, we should have at least sufficiently applied ourselves to some of these problems. We are not ambushing you or intending to ambush you, Dr. Lutz, but we do understand what you are raising. But we want it's a task for all of us to think about them, so that in our next meeting we can have a further discussion on them. Is that fine, members?
Yes, Chairperson, in order, thanks.
Thank you very much. Dr. Dupree?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this stage. Thank you very much for the opportunity to have addressed the committee again and for your understanding in connection with the late submission of the document. Chair, I suppose that you would like a fairly cleaned up document then before Friday. Thank you, Chair. We'll do our utmost best to submit that as soon as possible. But from my side, no, Chair, I haven't got anything else to add.
Yes, no, we do understand, Dr. Dupree, that you are working, in fact, your team and the Parliament's team, Dr. Lutz, you are working under very difficult conditions. We are also, these are conditions not of our own choosing, and we've just find ourselves having to deal with a number of bills at once. And because of the pandemic that is facing us, that is the domestic violence that is engulfing our country, that we have to, as expeditiously as we can, ensure that we pass these bills, but also ensuring that we pass bills that can withstand constitutional scrutiny and that can also be implementable without collapsing the public service, but at the same time that do justice in fighting the scourge of domestic violence against our women, children, and vulnerable groups in our country. And so, members, can we meet at 2 o'clock on Tuesday to still work on this document? Tomorrow we will start with the domestic violence. Our meeting will start at 9:30 tomorrow. So we will be receiving it will be the first working document after the public hearings on domestic violence. Who is going to be presenting that from the side of the department? Do you know, Dr. Dupree?
Are you talking about the domestic violence, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Chair, yes, that would be Mr. Roberts, sir. Mr. Roberts and Mr. Lynn Clark. Chair, okay. You said you'll resume on the sexual offences on Tuesday, 2 o'clock.
Did
you mean possibly? Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
I'm not sure whether. Is it a plea to ask for Tuesday, or you seriously forgot about what we said?
Mr. Chair, I'll be able to give you a working document at 2 o'clock this afternoon, so let's go for it.
No, thank you very much.
I'm being arrogant.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Because our operational date by which we want to conclude these bills is the 12th of March. So that is why we are really putting everybody under pressure. But thank you very much, members. Let's meet on Friday, 2 o'clock, to proceed with the criminal law sexual offenses. And then tomorrow we will meet to deal with the domestic violence. We will meet Mr. Dupris tomorrow at 9:30. Thank you very much, honorable members. And to everybody who is part of this meeting, thank you for your attendance, your support and guidance.
Thank you, Chip.
The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. DeBruce.